Joining us now is Shane Carpenter, program manager at Sacramento Access Radio, who is also a local high school teacher in the field of communications. Shane is here to talk to us about radio, as in its beginning, its early days. Shane, I guess the person we have to start with is the so-called father of radio, Guglielmo Marconi. Marconi, from what I've read here, was this guy, this Italian fellow born to, a well-to-do family, who did a little bit of study of, the work of Hertz and people before him, and was intrigued by the possibility of sending signals over space without wires. So he set out to create a device capable of doing that, and apparently within 1 year had done so.
That's the truth. He had studied the theories of Maxwell, and also with the work that Heinrich Hertz had done to prove the theories, transmitting electromagnetic waves. He became really obsessed with the idea that you could use this technology to transmit sound. He did most of his studies, actually, in Bologna, Italy, and his father was Italian and his mother was an Irish. Actually, did most of his work in physics in Florence, actually.
Huh. I'm astounded to discover that the Italian government showed no interest in his device, and he wound up having to travel to England where he obtained a patent on it.
England had a lot more to gain from this new idea of wireless telegraphy because, you know, they had a vast empire, and the Italian government, it's kind of interesting, that they, pretty much gave him the big denial there. You know, his mother is actually the one that took Marconi to England and brought it before their government, and they saw a great need to use this in ship-to-shore communications. Marconi used Morse code to accomplish this, because at that time, voice communication hadn't been perfected, even invented. It wasn't until folks like DeForest invented the Audion tube that allowed continuous wave transmission. So basically, this was an on and off means of communication, and so he adopted Morse code. And actually, the first letter that he sent was S.
And across the Atlantic.
Yep, exactly. 1895, he made his first transmission, and then in 1909, he won the Nobel Prize for his work in physics. And then, when the Titanic sank in 1912, this technology was still fairly new, and even though they were sending out distress signals via Morse code, folks still didn't quite understand what was going on. So a lot of people actually heard the distress call, but they didn't really know what to make of it.
Yeah, and I guess that there was some issue whether they could have gotten them rescued more quickly, and if the other ship had a radio operator on board, there might have been less of a loss of life. And I guess they enacted legislation afterwards to make sure that all ocean-going vessels actually had a radio room.
Exactly. Marconi's company, Marconi Wireless Limited, that was formed in Britain, and then later on was World War II showed up at that point. Then he started doing work in shortwave. He went back to the Italian government and worked with them during the war and did their work in shortwave communications. It's kind of interesting, too, a little side note, that he also invented the radio direction finder to help ships and planes locate themselves.
Huh.
Radio waves, yeah.
Which I guess the Japanese were able later to use to find their way to Pearl Harbor. Yeah, you still use the non-directional beacon in aircraft, which I guess is probably that. I guess we owe that to Marconi.
Yep.
Huh, I didn't know that.
The technology had to await the development of the diode and the triode, so in order to have continuous wave communications.
Well, I remember doing the calculations back in physics days many moons ago about the energy that electromagnetic radiation carries, and my recollection is it's directly proportional to the frequency of the waves. And radio waves, of course, are very low frequency compared to, say, light, and they therefore contain very little energy. And to get a significant amount of information across, I guess you really have to amplify that weak signal.
Yeah, you definitely need to amplify it quite a bit in order to get some distance out of it. It's actually kind of surprising that he was able to get across the Atlantic without use of more powerful amplifiers.
Yeah, I remember having a crystal set back in high school that had no amplification, and no, that thing was not very loud. I mean, you could get a radio signal across, but boy, I mean, it was just barely audible.
Well, and also, too, transmission of a sine wave is not, is a lot easier to do. When you start modulating sound with radio waves, and that's where you really need the power.
Well, I guess it's about 1906 then that here in America we have a young rival to Marconi who comes along, who's got big dreams, named Lee DeForest, who is, I guess, I gather, quite a tinkerer, an inventor in the Edison scope, although perhaps considerably less talented than Thomas Edison. But I guess through his tinkering, DeForest evidently just stumbled upon this audion tube, which is basically today's triode, which he didn't understand how it worked, but he understood that it was able to amplify signals.
That's correct. And I know you and I were talking a while back, and there is some debate as to whether he actually could be credited with that or not.
Well, he apparently stole from everybody he could and was something of a roué. They described him on the Ken Burns Empires of the Air series, a bit of a ne'er-do-well, kind of a shady operator, self-aggrandizing, but, you know, a man who did make a contribution.
Yeah, I'll say one thing. I have a picture of him in one of these textbooks, and he does look sort of like, some kind of an evil genius or
yeah,
something like that.
A weasel.
Yeah.
We want to introduce probably at this point this wonderful series on Ken Burns that he did on the Empires of the Air.
Oh, definitely.
The genius of radio. I mean, of the three people covered in, they basically mentioned Marconi and then focus in on the three Americans who basically made radio what it is today. Lee DeForest, Edwin Howard Armstrong, far and away the least known of the three, and David Sarnoff. And Armstrong is a truly amazing character, an electronics genius who basically, by 1912, invents a way of further amplifying radio waves and enables us to build radio sets that are practical. Armstrong, who basically looked at the audion tube, as Lee DeForest called his triode, decided to figure out how it was working to amplify radio signals, figured it out, and was able to make some breakthroughs. I guess first in 1912 and then a further breakthrough in World War II that basically allowed radio sets to become a commercial entity, something where you could have an amplifier, like what we think of as a portable radio today.
You know, the interesting dichotomy there is that as radio sets were becoming more and more viable, the question became what to actually put on the radio. A lot of manufacturers like General Electric and Westinghouse, who had made their fortunes in radio actually during World War One, they were hesitant to make radio sets because there wasn't that much radio programming, and they stalled the development of the industry for a little bit there until Westinghouse's station decided just to go for it and start a little network, and it actually turned out that people would indeed listen on a regular basis, and from that time on, they decided, they actually found that they could sell radios based on that, and that's sort of what gave it a big boost there. The corporation that Marconi founded in the United States, Marconi America, they had a big industry in the wireless industry, and then after the war, America started to go through this isolationist movement. The government decided that it was actually too much of a national security issue to have foreign powers in control of this technology.
Huh.
So they made Marconi divest of his company, and then that's what actually became Radio Corporation of America.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's the old Marconi America.
So in the 20s, you've got this, they're starting to sell sets by the 100,000, and broadcasting then grows up to basically go along hand in glove with the hardware. I'm a little unclear on the 20s. I sort of think of the 20s as a time of the movies, the silent films, and sports heroes. But I guess by the 30s, radio starts its golden age. I'm a little unclear what happened in the 20s, except I guess it's a matter of slow growth.
Well, actually, during the 20s, you had stations like KDKA in Pennsylvania and WEAF is in Boston. These stations start to grow, and there is. It's kind of a slow growth. There are milestones to encourage the public to start listening to radio. And we see broadcast sort of organizations like AT&T getting into the act, too. As the 30s progress, you start to see the growth of the network. You have NBC and CBS.
William Paley over at CBS tries to follow in Sarnoff's footsteps and builds another network that's nationwide.
Actually, yes, there's kind of a battle between the two, and in a way, CBS is the underdog because NBC at this point is pretty much the king of the hill. And matter of fact, they were actually so big that the government, through its antitrust legislation, made them split. They had the red and the blue network.
Right.
And that's what the blue network is actually what became ABC.
That's amazing. Shades of Bill Gates.
Exactly.
Well, it's the 1930s, and all of a sudden, radio enters a golden age. Radio is king. And Jack Benny and Bing Crosby and other people become national figures, you know, akin to the biggest movie stars of today.
Indeed. You start to see the growth of the networks, quality means of communication. AT&T has by this time gotten out of the business, and they are in the exclusive position of wiring all the interconnect lines that hook the nation's radio stations together. You see networks starting to put lots of money into their programming. Regular programming is afoot nowadays, and you have the big stars, as you said, Jack Benny, and this is actually where the growth of music broadcasting starts coming in, as stations start to carry big band concerts. And
I guess it was a huge shot in the arm for the recording industry.
Exactly. It used to be, actually, that records were in competition with radios, but then here again, it was like they decided that they could actually sell more records by broadcasting records on the radios.
So by the 30s and 40s, Groucho Marx segues into radio. Jack Benny is huge. Burns and Allen become household words. Bob Hope. And it's almost no sooner has radio become king, and then TV comes along and knocks it off its throne.
You bet. Milestones like the Hindenburg crash and 1937 and all the way through the 40s, where you see World War II and broadcasts like Edward R. Murrow and broadcasts from London. That's where you find that radio at this point galvanizes the nation together and allows people to hear broadcasts from across the ocean and brings the war home. And even though television is invented in 1939, the war pretty much stifles it, and it doesn't come on the scene until after the war. It actually makes its debut, I believe, at the New York World's Fair in 39.
I still remember my grandmother, when I was a boy, quoting Franklin Roosevelt, which I'm sure was from one of his fireside chats, about how the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And even, you know, 30 years after that event, you know, she was still very inspired by that.
Yes, indeed. As a matter of fact, even presidents to this day use that metaphor, and it's pretty much in our household language today. So, yeah, you're right. As we see the war ending, 1950s are here, and radio makes a comeback through the advent of rock and roll.
I guess it did. I never thought about that.
Yeah, rock and roll is what actually brought people back to the radio, as people put more and more radios in their cars, and the genre is kind of a mobile lifestyle, music for life that way. Then folks start listening to AM radio again, and you see Wolfman Jack and Alan Freed and big disc jockeys like that start to come on the scene. At that point, there were radio personalities, but there weren't air personalities as we would know them today.
Good God, the birth of Howard Stern.
That's right. It all started with rock and roll.
Oh, brother. You know, one thing I was amazed in watching that Empires of the Air show was the side story of Edward Howard Armstrong engaging in bitter litigation, first with Lee DeForest, then with David Sarnoff, and that he wound up losing in a Supreme Court. I guess the Supreme Court finally ruled against him that DeForest had actually invented the tube, the Audion tube, which he had held a lot of the patents on for refining it, and all the engineers agreed that it really was Armstrong who deserved the credit for it.
Yeah, that's it. Armstrong actually invented the device, but as history shows, to the victor go the spoils.
Or the guy with the best lawyer.
Exactly.
Armstrong sits down and basically develops FM radio.
And FM radio is actually what gave the radio industry another boost as 20 years later, actually.
Except that, yes, in the 1930s, when Armstrong cannot interest David Sarnoff, his buddy at RCA, into going with this new method, because Sarnoff says, well, what about all the other sets I've got out there?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know why they couldn't think of doing an AM/FM like we have today, but somehow I guess that didn't dawn on anybody. Sarnoff saw Armstrong as competition, and Armstrong decides, well, screw you, I'm going to build an FM national network that's going to compete with AM. He sets out to do so. At one point, there's 500,000 sets across the nation. And then I guess World War II breaks out, and the value of FM is recognized militarily, and Armstrong just turns his patents over to the U.S. government.
It is a testament to the strength of character of Mr. Armstrong, too, that he would turn over the patents to the government like that.
And then the really ugly part enters in when the war ends, and it's time to build television receivers, and it's clear that the voice portion of television is going to be frequency modulation radio. And Sarnoff then decides that he is just not going to pay Armstrong any money for the patents, fights him in court, and uses the full resources of RCA to deny Armstrong what is rightfully his. He even lobbies the government to change what the recognized frequencies of FM are so that Armstrong's receiving sets are now obsolete. This is a really dirty pool.
Yeah, that was definitely a bitter battle between the two folks. It shows you the way the whole corporate mentality is. All these radio plays, and they sort of went over into television and started being produced with pictures. And
Jack Benny jumped to TV. Jack Webb took Dragnet to TV. Gunsmoke went to TV.
Yeah, a lot of these, a lot of the shows that you see, and especially even today, the soap operas that you see on television, those are direct descendants of the original radio broadcast.
I didn't realize that soaps were really big back in the 30s, I guess.
Oh, yeah, they were. And it's kind of interesting. As you see reality television, there was a lot of what was called reality radio back then, where you'd actually ride along with you know, with law enforcement. And so a lot of this stuff that you see is kind of like brand new is actually not new at all. It's just a rehash of older ideas that people have already produced. You know, towards the 50s, you see rock and roll radio, and then FM comes along and finally becomes a viable medium. And
yeah, FM really was the kind of took the back seat to AM. I remember FM.
Sure.
You know, even in the 60s, being thought of as classical music, stuffy, you know, goofy, you know, highbrow sort of stuff.
A lot of the rock and roll that we know today is classic rock. It got its start on FM. The underground, you know, sort of acid rock stations, you had those, and you had the classical stations, and you know, the big development was that FM could be transmitted in stereo, and then that, little by little, garnered most of the music broadcast, and then AM was relegated to talk radio.
That's pretty much what it's been ever since, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. Through the 70s, you'd have, you know, country music radio, and talk radio, and sports, news talk, things like that would be, you know, traditionally AM territory. And then as you'd have the divergence of music formats, those would be more on the FM side. And that's where you see the development of format radio. And then you see the beginnings of syndicated radio, and then automation radio sort of takes hold at that point, and then folks generally rebel against that. And then in the 80s, automation starts taking over again, and you see major syndication like the Westwood Run One radio network, and a lot of satellite delivered broadcasting. And
how do we get Rush Limbaugh out of that?
Yeah, actually, he was a product of Sacramento, believe it or not.
Yeah, I know that.
And I guess he had enough wind to carry him all the way across the country.
Talk is big. I mean, I think it's bigger than ever right now.
Well, that's the thing. And even back as early as probably the early 90s, talk radio really started booming. And you see talk show hosts. Even shock jocks starting to come into it. You know, that's where Howard Stern starts to come into it. And
Don Imus. And
Imus, yeah, and Likas. And
what do you see happening with the internet and radio?
Well, actually, the internet is what's probably going to shake the foundation of radio, terrestrial radio as we know it. You start to see a lot of people like ourselves, Access Sacramento. The ability for anybody to have their own radio station, all it takes is a computer, and you get the diversity, I think, that the founding fathers really wanted to see in radio.
Yeah.
And that is actually, I think, what's going to make broadcast mediums, stand up and take notice. They're they're really scared, actually.
I'm very excited at the fact that this very program right now can be picked up in Finland or any place else over the internet. That's very interesting. Shane Carpenter, thank you very much for coming on to our show and talking about radio.
Always a pleasure, anytime.